Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and this morning's conversation with Dr. Elias Zerhouni, Director of the National Institutes of Health. And joining us in our conversation is Tony Hess. Well, Dr. Zerhouni, how do you envision NIH 5 to 10 years from now?
Well, I think it's clear that in the next 5-10 years, you're going to see a complete change in the way we make medical discoveries, clearly, because we've just completed the human genome in 2003. And the rate at which these discoveries are occurring, where we are now discovering the fundamental code that is disturbed in any one disease. In 2003, I can tell you the second most important discovery that was ranked by Science magazine worldwide was the first discoveries that we made at NIH of the genes responsible for mental health conditions like schizophrenia or manic depressive illnesses. Last year, we discovered a gene that we had discarded 3 years ago in diabetes. And all of a sudden, because of the better tools that we have, now we understand that. A month ago, we discovered a gene that seemed to be very, very important in the development of what we call age macular degeneration, which is loss of vision in older people. It is one of the most important rising causes of disability in seniors, loss of vision due to age-related macular degeneration. And lo and behold, it was a gene that had to do with a protein in the blood, nothing to do with the eye itself. And that is opening up a completely different world of research. So you're going to see, I think, in 5-10 years, a better understanding of what we call complex diseases, where things are interacting with each other. Second, a completely new paradigm of medicine is going to emerge, whereby we're going to know much better your personal risk factors and what we need to do years before any disease strikes you or me or a patient. That's the hope. For example, we're actively searching for a way to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease. We know that if we can delay it by 5 years, we'll save 50% of the cost of Alzheimer's disease. So I think you're going to see an NIH where our understanding of the complexity of diseases through the systems approach, based on our finalization of the human genome, is going to completely change the way research is done and more importantly, how medicine is practiced.
Earlier, you talked about the importance of recruiting top talent in your organization. Could you talk to us a little bit about that? And I'm especially interested as to sort of how you deal with some of the constraints or maybe the perception of constraints people have about joining government service.
That's a very good question. I consider it the number one job of a manager leader in any one of our government organizations because I used to say when I compare my recruiting efforts as NIH director compared to what I used to do when I was executive dean at Johns Hopkins, I say, you know, recruiting as an NIH director is almost like fighting with one hand behind your back because of the constraints that government service brings. So you have to be able to identify people who are motivated by the notion that you give them something absolutely unique. Why did I go to NIH myself? The reason is because you can have an influence on your field or discipline that is unparalleled. So you give up on your personal rewards, if you will. But at the end, I always tell my potential recruits as they think about it, on your last day, when you will look back, and you say, I had the chance to serve the country for several years and in a capacity that is unique, which is that of being an institute director at NIH, what would you say? And that's what I try to portray. I really show the qualitative differences, not the quantitative differences, and the empowerment that you have as a government scientist and a government leader in science, that you can then view over time as a unique opportunity for contribution. So that's how I combine the two. But it's hard because, you know, Washington has become an expensive area to move to. Our compensation systems are quite rigid in the government. To attract people who are at the top of their field, you need to compete with universities and so on. And I do. I compete very aggressively. The one thing that we can offer is a research environment that is just unparalleled in the world and the ability to influence a discipline that is just unparalleled in the world. And those are the two things you have to combine. But I spend an enormous amount of time in recruitment. For example, one strategy that I use that people find funny is that I would go personally and visit the candidates in their own laboratory, their own universities. And you would be amazed how effective that is to find out if there is a cultural match and a managerial spirit that will fit within a government agency. That's important, too. You don't want to mismatch an individual to a position.
What advice can you give to government executives who face the challenge of collaboration within their own complex organizations?
Oh, that's a very tough question. First and foremost, I think that credibility and trust are the two things you have to build. You cannot get collaboration if people don't trust you and don't think you're credible. And it's interesting when I say that, you know, in my experience, both at Hopkins, my previous department, previous activities, the fact that collaboration requires commitment on both parties, it requires also that you build a huge amount of credibility and trust. It's based on that. You can have all the organization charts you want, all the workshops and meetings and staff meetings. If there isn't that, you'll have a problem. So that relates then to how you use your leadership position. And the one thing that I find very, very important is my definition of leadership is heart, spine, and brains. I'm a doctor, you know, remember. And the heart is people have to feel you have a passion for what you do and that you're honest. And that's why I say candor is an instrument of leadership, because candor generates trust. And the second is spine. They have to know that they can trust you if things get rough, that you will honor your side of the bargain. And credibility comes from people thinking that, yeah, he's above average too, at least in an agency like NIH. So there is a little bit of all of that combined. But collaboration also comes from, like I said, sharing information and raw data. People are data-driven in a knowledge organization.
Also in the context of collaboration, how great a role do you see the private industry working with the NIH in the future is, and do you see this on the increase, you know, in terms of the number of partnerships with between the public and the private sector?
I think it's going to have to increase. If you look at funding for medical research, in 1991, NIH was co-equal with industry. In 1970, NIH funded 80% of all medical research and industry very little. And since 1991, industry is funding more and more research and development in biomedicine at an increasing rate. So even though NIH's budget doubled, the investments in the private sector have more than tripled. And the reason is very simple. It is quite difficult to understand biology to the point where you can be effective. And NIH is not going to be able to duplicate what the pharmaceutical sector, biotech sector does. So we need to find ways of improving, increasing the ability of partnering between the public government, academia, and the private sector. But we need to do this while being very careful about not losing public trust. And that's the issue of managing relationships in a way that's transparent, fully disclosed, so there's no sense that anybody's being taken advantage of. So I think those are the characteristics that I see in the future. More public-private partnership driven by more transparent and more perhaps more demanding ethical rules.
Normally, our last question in this show asks about advice you'd give to someone interested in a career in public service. And I think you gave us a pretty good insight based on how you described how you recruit. But let me ask you to focus on that word career. Do you think that's something, especially around science, that people would seek to have in government? Or do you think moving across the sectors, as you've described a couple of years, is something that might become more traditional?
Well, first of all, I can only take myself as an example. And I move from one area of science to another. I move from one role to another. I think a career in public service requires, in my view, a proactive development strategies. And it is very important that we develop what I call leadership development strategies. What I did when I was at Hopkins, I used that same strategy to bring young investigators, young scientists, young faculty members to a development program. And then we placed them in different positions, in different places in the university so they can accumulate experience. So a career in public service, to me, should be managed in the same way. If you think a career in public service is stay in some place 25 years and get a retirement package, that's just not going to be the way of the future. So I think we need to really do this aggressively. We have an aging workforce that is going to retire, a large percentage of which is going to retire sooner. We need to give a lot more experiential opportunities, I think, for our career service employees, and everybody who comes to government service should be able to have that open mind. But we have to come up with a way where, in fact, doing that is rewarding, not punishing.
That's a good last point. Dr. Zahuni, Tony, and I want to thank you for joining us this morning and being with us today.
Tony, Paul, thank you for the job you're doing. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks. One thing that I'd like to say, if you don't mind, is NIH is very complex, and we have a great website called www.nih.gov, and anyone who's interested in some of the things I said is welcome to come.
Thanks. This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Dr. Elias Zahuni, Director of the National Institutes of Health. Be sure and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's fascinating conversation. Once again, that's businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Radio Hour, I'm Paul Lawrence. Thank you for listening.